Chapter 10. Unforgettable days of that gale which my mate also delighted to extol as famous shove. And this is one of those gales whose memory in after years returns, welcome in dignified austerity, as you would remember with pleasure the noble features of a stranger with whom you crossed swords once in knightly encounter, and are never to see again. In this way gales have their physiognomy. You remember them by your own feelings, and no two gales stamp themselves in the same way upon your emotions. Some cling to you in weeping and misery. Others come back fiercely and weirdly, like ghouls bent upon sucking your strength away. Others, again, have a catastrophic splendor. Some are unvenerated recollections, as of spiteful wild cats clawing at your agonized vitals. Others are severe, like a visitation. And one or two rise up draped and mysterious, with an aspect of ominous menace. In each of them there is a characteristic point at which the whole feeling seems contained in one single moment. Thus there is a certain 4 o'clock in the morning in the confused roar of a black and white world, when coming on deck, to take charge of my watch I received the instantaneous impression that the ship could not live for another hour in such a raging sea. I wonder what became of the men who silently you couldn't hear yourself speak, must have shared that conviction with me. To be left to write about it is not, perhaps, the most enviable fate, but the point is that this impression resumes in its intensity the whole recollection of days and days of desperately dangerous weather. We were then, for reasons which it is not worthwhile to specify, in the close neighborhood of Kerguelen Land. And now, when I open an atlas and look at the tiny dots on the map of the Southern Ocean, I see as if engraved upon the paper the enraged physiognomy of that gale. Another, strangely, recalls a silent man. And yet it was not din that was wanting. In fact, it was terrific. That one was a gale that came upon the ship swiftly, like a pampero, which last is a very sudden wind indeed. Before we knew very well what was coming, all the sails we had set had burst. The furled ones were blowing loose, ropes flying, sea hissing it hissed tremendously, wind howling, and the ship lying on her side, so that half of the crew were swimming and the other half clawing desperately at whatever came to hand. According to the side of the deck, each man had been caught on by the catastrophe, either to leeward or to windward. The shouting I need not mention, it was the merest drop in an ocean of noise, and yet the character of the gale seems contained in the recollection of one small, not particularly impressive sallow man without a cap, and with a very still face. Captain Jones, let us call him Jones, had been caught unawares. Two orders he had given at the first sign of an utterly unforeseen onset. After that the magnitude of his mistake seemed to have overwhelmed him. We were doing what was needed and feasible. The ship behaved well. Of course, it was some time before we could pause in our fierce and laborious exertions. But all through the work, the excitement, the uproar, and some dismay, we were aware of this silent little man at the break of the poop, perfectly motionless, soundless, and often hidden from us by the drift of sprays. When we officers clambered at last upon the poop, he seemed to come out of that numbed composure, and shouted to us downwind, "Dry the pumps!" Afterwards he disappeared. As to the ship, I need not say that, although she was presently swallowed up in one of the blackest nights I can remember, she did not disappear. In truth, I don't fancy that there had ever been much danger of that, but certainly the experience was noisy, and particularly distracting, and yet it is the memory of a very quiet silence that survives. XXIV. For, after all, a gale of wind, the thing of mighty sound, is inarticulate. It is man who, in a chance phrase, interprets the elemental passion of his enemy. Thus there is another gale in my memory, a thing of endless, deep, humming roar, moonlight, and a spoken sentence. It was off that other cape which is always deprived of its title as the Cape of Good Hope, is robbed of its name. It was off the Horn. For a true expression of disheveled wildness there is nothing like a gale in the bright moonlight of a high latitude. The ship, brought to and bowing to enormous flashing seas, glistened wet from deck to trucks. Her one set sail stood out a coal-black shape upon the gloomy blueness of the air. I was a youngster then, and suffering from weariness, cold, and imperfect oilskins which let water in at every seam. I craved human companionship, and, coming off the poop, took my place by the side of the boatswain, a man whom I did not like, in a comparatively dry spot, where at worst we had water only up to our knees. Above our heads the explosive booming gusts of wind passed continuously, justifying the sailors saying, "Tea blows great guns." And just from that need of human companionship, being very close to the man, I said, or rather shouted, "Blows very hard, boatswain." His answer was, "Eh, and if it blows only a little harder things will begin to go. I don't mind, as long as everything holds, but when things begin to go it's bad." The note of dread in the shouting voice, the practical truth of these words, heard years ago from a man I did not like, have stamped its peculiar character on that gale. A look in the eyes of a shipmate, a low murmur in the most sheltered spot, where the watch on duty are huddled together, a meaning moan from one to the other with a glance at the windward sky, a sigh of weariness, a gesture of disgust passing into the keeping of the great wind, become part and parcel of the gale. The olive hue of hurricane clouds presents an aspect peculiarly appalling. The inky ragged rack, flying before a nor'west wind, makes you dizzy with its headlong speed that depicts the rush of the invisible air. A hard sou'wester startles you with its close horizon and its low gray sky, as if the world were a dungeon wherein there is no rest for body or soul. And there are black squalls, white squalls, thunder squalls, and unexpected gusts that come without a single sign in the sky, and of each kind, no one of them resembles another. There is infinite variety in the gales of wind at sea, and except for the peculiar, terrible, and mysterious moaning that may be heard sometimes passing through the roar of a hurricane, except for that unforgettable sound, as if the soul of the universe had been goaded into a mournful groan, it is, after all, the human voice that stamps the mark of human consciousness upon the character of a gale. XXV. There is no part of the world of coasts, continents, oceans, seas, straits, capes, and islands which is not under the sway of a reigning wind, the sovereign of its typical weather. The wind rules the aspects of the sky, and the action of the sea. But no wind rules unchallenged his realm of land and water. As with the kingdoms of the earth, there are regions more turbulent than others. In the middle belt of the earth the trade winds reign supreme, undisputed, like monarchs of long-settled kingdoms, whose traditional power, checking all undue ambitions, is not so much an exercise of personal might as the working of long-established institutions. The intertropical kingdoms of the trade winds are favorable to the ordinary life of a merchantman. The trumpet call of strife is seldom borne on their wings to the watchful ears of men on the decks of ships. The regions ruled by the northeast and southeast trade winds are serene. In a southern-going ship, bound out for a long voyage, the passage through their dominions is characterized by a relaxation of strain and vigilance on the part of the seamen. Those citizens of the ocean feel sheltered under the aegis of an uncontested law, of an undisputed dynasty. There, indeed, if anywhere on earth, the weather may be trusted. Yet not too implicitly. Even in the constitutional realm of trade winds, north and south of the equator, ships are overtaken by strange disturbances. Still, the easterly winds, and, generally speaking, the easterly weather all the world over, is characterized by regularity and persistence. As a ruler, the east wind has a remarkable stability. As an invader of the high latitudes lying under the tumultuous sway of his great brother, the wind of the west, he is extremely difficult to dislodge, by the reason of his cold craftiness and profound duplicity. the narrow seas around these isles, where British admirals keep watch and ward upon the marches of the Atlantic Ocean, are subject to the turbulent sway of the west wind. Call it northwest or southwest, it is all one a different phase of the same character, a changed expression on the same face. In the orientation of the winds that rule the seas, the north and south directions are of no importance. There are no north and south winds of any account upon this earth. The north and south winds are but small princes in the dynasties that make peace and war upon the sea. They never assert themselves upon a vast stage. They depend upon local causes, the configuration of coasts, the shapes of straits, the accidents of bold promontories round which they play their little part. In the polity of winds, as amongst the tribes of the earth, the real struggle lies between east and west. XXVI. The west wind reigns over the seas surrounding the coasts of these kingdoms, and from the gateways of the channels, from promontories as if from watchtowers, from estuaries of rivers, as if from postern gates, from passageways, inlets, straits, firths, the garrison of the island, the crews of the ships going and returning look to the westward to judge by the varied splendors of his sunset mantle the mood of that arbitrary ruler. The end of the day is the time to gaze at the kingly face of the westerly weather, who is the arbiter of ships' destinies. Benignant and splendid, or splendid and sinister, the western sky reflects the hidden purposes of the royal mind. Clothed in a mantle of dazzling gold, or draped in rags of black clouds like a beggar, the might of the westerly wind sits enthroned upon the western horizon with the whole North Atlantic as a footstool for his feet, and the first twinkling stars making a diadem for his brow. Then the seamen, attentive courtiers of the weather, think of regulating the conduct of their ships by the mood of the master. The west wind is too great a king to be a dissembler. He is no calculator plotting deep schemes in a somber heart. He is too strong for small artifices. There is passion in all his moods, even in the soft mood of his serene days, in the grace of his blue sky whose immense and unfathomable tenderness reflected in the mirror of the sea embraces, possesses, lulls to sleep the ships with white sails. He is all things to all oceans. He is like a poet seated upon a throne magnificent, simple, barbarous, pensive, generous, impulsive, changeable, unfathomable, but when you understand him, always the same. Some of his sunsets are like pageants devised for the delight of the multitude, when all the gems of the royal treasure house are displayed above the sea. Others are like the opening of his royal confidence, tinged with thoughts of sadness and compassion in a melancholy splendor meditating upon the short-lived peace of the waters. And I have seen him put the pent-up anger of his heart into the aspect of the inaccessible sun, and cause it to glare fiercely like the eye of an implacable autocrat out of a pale and frightened sky. He is the warlord who sends his battalions of Atlantic rollers to the assault of our seaboard. The compelling voice of the west wind musters up to his service all the might of the ocean. At the bidding of the west wind there arises a great commotion in the sky above these islands, and a great rush of waters falls upon our shores. The sky of the westerly weather is full of flying clouds, of great big white clouds coming thicker and thicker till they seem to stand welded into a solid canopy, upon whose gray face the lower rack of the gale, thin, black and angry looking, flies past with vertiginous speed. Denser and denser grows this dome of vapors, descending lower and lower upon the sea, narrowing the horizon around the ship. And the characteristic aspect of westerly weather, the thick, gray, smoky and sinister tone sets in, circumscribing the view of the men, drenching their bodies, oppressing their souls, taking their breath away with booming gusts, deafening, blinding, driving, rushing them onwards in a swaying ship towards our coasts lost in mists and rain. The caprice of the winds, like the willfulness of men, is fraught with the disastrous consequences of self-indulgence. Long anger, the sense of his uncontrolled power, spoils the frank and generous nature of the west wind. It is as if his heart were corrupted by a malevolent and brooding rancor. He devastates his own kingdom in the wantonness of his force. Southwest is the quarter of the heavens, where he presents his darkened brow. He breathes his rage in terrific squalls, and overwhelms his realm with an inexhaustible welter of clouds. He strews the seeds of anxiety upon the decks of scudding ships, makes the foam-stripped ocean look old, and sprinkles with gray hairs the heads of shipmasters in the homeward-bound ships running for the channel. The westerly wind asserting his sway from the southwest quarter is often like a monarch gone mad, driving forth with wild imprecations the most faithful of his courtiers to shipwreck, disaster, and death. The southwesterly weather is the thick weather par excellence. It is not the thickness of the fog. It is rather a contraction of the horizon, a mysterious veiling of the shores with clouds, that seem to make a low-vaulted dungeon around the running ship. It is not blindness. It is a shortening of the sight. The west wind does not say to the seaman, "You shall be blind." It restricts merely the range of his vision, and raises the dread of land within his breast. It makes of him a man robbed of half his force, of half his efficiency. Many times in my life, standing in long sea boots and streaming oilskins at the elbow of my commander on the poop of a homeward-bound ship making for the channel, and gazing ahead into the gray and tormented waste, I have heard a weary sigh shape itself into a studiously casual comment. "Can't see very far in this weather." And have made answer in the same low, perfunctory tone, "No, sir." It would be merely the instinctive voicing of an ever-present thought associated closely with the consciousness of the land somewhere ahead, and of the great speed of the ship. Fair wind, fair wind. Who would dare to grumble at a fair wind? It was a favor of the Western King, who rules masterfully the North Atlantic from the latitude of the Azores to the latitude of Cape Farewell. A famous shove this to end a good passage with. And yet, somehow, one could not muster upon one's lips the smile of a courtier's gratitude. This favor was dispensed to you from under an overbearing scowl, which is the true expression of the great autocrat, when he has made up his mind, to give a battering to some ships, and to hunt certain others home in one breath of cruelty and benevolence, equally distracting. "No, sir. Can't see very far." Thus would the mate's voice repeat the thought of the master, both gazing ahead, while under their feet the ship rushes at some 12 knots, in the direction of the lee shore, and only a couple of miles in front of her swinging and dripping jib boom, carried naked with an upward slant like a spear, a gray horizon closes the view with a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.